up again. So, too, with one of his knees and a small area on the top of his hand. Pieces of father froze very casually, and Perry said this was the fate of some men in the North, and nothing could be done about it. Perry was not an unkind commander, and he liked father. During the long winter months aboard the Roosevelt, they had discovered themselves members of the same national collegiate fraternity, and this was no light bond between them. But after a lifetime of effort, Perry was impatient to get his task done. Father's society had paid a good sum into the Perry chest, and for it they got their man to 72 degrees 46 minutes, a very respectable way. Before he left, father presented the commander with an American flag he had manufactured for the occasion. It was pure silk and a good size, but when folded had no more bulk than a large handkerchief. Perry thanked him, put the flag inside his furs, and after warning father to look out for the leads, sent him on his return journey to the Roosevelt in the company of 3 bad-tempered Eskimos. But now Perry was within a day's travel of his lifelong goal. Driving Henson and the Eskimos mercilessly, he'd refused to let them sleep more than an hour or two at the end of each arduous day. Now the sun shone brightly, the sky was clear. There was a full moon in the blue sky, and the great ice thighs of the earth heaved and shuddered and rose toward the moon. At mid-morning of April 9, Perry called a halt. He ordered Henson to build a snow shield to protect him while he took his observations. Perry lay on his stomach, and with a pan of mercury and a sextant, some paper and a pencil, he calculated his position. It did not satisfy him. He walked further along the floe and took another sighting. This did not satisfy him. All day long, Perry shuffled back and forth over the ice, a mile one way, 2 miles another, and made his observations. No one observation satisfied him. He would walk a few steps due north and find himself going due south. On this watery planet, the sliding sea refused to be fixed. He couldn't find the exact place to say, this spot here is the North Pole. Nevertheless, there was no question that they were there. All the observations together indicated that. "Give 3 cheers, my boy," he told Henson, "and let's fly the flag." Henson and the Eskimos cheered loudly, but could not be heard in the howling wind. The flag snapped and rippled. Perry posed Henson and the Eskimos in front of the flag and took their picture. It shows 5 stubby figures wrapped in furs, the flag set in a paleocristic peak behind them that might suggest a real physical pole. Because of the light, the faces are indistinguishable, seen only as black blanks framed by caribou fur. Chapter 11. Back home, a momentous change was coming over the United States. There was a new president, William Howard Taft, and he took office weighing 332 pounds. All over the country, men began to look at themselves. They were used to drinking great quantities of beer. They customarily devoured loaves of bread and ate prodigiously of the sausage meats of poured offal that lay on the lunch counters of the saloons. The august Pierpont Morgan would routinely consume 7- and 8-course dinners. He ate breakfasts of steaks and chops, eggs, pancakes, broiled fish, rolls and butter, fresh fruit and cream. The consumption of food was a sacrament of success. A man who carried a great stomach before him was thought to be in his prime. Women went into hospitals to die of burst bladders, collapsed lungs, overtaxed hearts, and meningitis of the spine. There was a heavy traffic to the spas and sulfur springs, where the purgative was valued as an inducement to the appetite. America was a great farting country. All this began to change when Taft moved into the White House. His accession to the one mythic office in the American imagination weighed everyone down. His great figure immediately expressed the apotheosis of that style of man. Thereafter, fashion would go the other way, and only poor people would be stout. In this regard, as in most others, Evelyn Nesbit was ahead of her time. Her former chief lover, Stanford White, had been a fashionably burly man, and her husband, Harry K. Thaw, though not as large, was nevertheless soft and wide. But her new lover, mother's younger brother, was as lean and hard as a young tree. They made love slowly and sinuously, humping each other into such supple states of orgasm that they found very little reason to talk the rest of the time they were together. It was characteristic of Evelyn that she could not resist someone who was so strongly attracted to her. She led younger brother around the Lower East Side in a futile search for Tata and the little girl. The flat on Hester Street had been abandoned. Evelyn took up the lease and paid the landlord for the pitiful furnishings. She spent hours sitting by the window on the air shaft. She would touch things, a blanket, a plate, like a blind person trying to read with her fingers. Then she would break down and be soothed by Mother's younger brother in the narrow brass bed. When the trial of Harry K. Thaw began, Evelyn was photographed arriving at the courthouse. In the courtroom, where no photographers were allowed, she was drawn by artists for the illustrateds. She could hear the scratching of the steel pens. She took the witness stand and described herself at 15, pumping her legs in a red velvet swing, while a wealthy architect caught his breath at the sight of her exposed calves. She was resolute and held her head high. She was dressed in impeccable taste. Her testimony created the first sex goddess in American history. Two elements of the society realized this. The first was the business community, specifically a group of accountants and cloak-and-suit manufacturers who also dabbled in the exhibition of moving pictures, or picture shows as they were called. Some of these men saw the way Evelyn's face on the front page of a newspaper sold out the edition. They realized that there was a process of magnification by which news events established certain individuals in the public consciousness as larger than life. These were the individuals who represented one desirable human characteristic to the exclusion of all others. The businessmen wondered if they could create such individuals, not from the accidents of news events, but from the deliberate manufactures of their own medium. If they could, more people would pay money for the picture shows. Thus did Evelyn provide the inspiration for the concept of the movie star system and the model for every sex goddess from Theda Bara to Jean Harlow. The second group of people to perceive Evelyn's importance was made up of various trade union leaders, anarchists, and socialists, who correctly prophesied that she would in the long run be a greater threat to the working man's interests than mine owners or steel manufacturers. In Seattle, for instance, Emma Goldman spoke to an IWW local and cited Evelyn Nesbit as a daughter of the working class whose life was a lesson in the way all daughters and sisters of poor men were used for the pleasure of the wealthy. The men in her audience guffawed and shouted out lewd remarks and broke into laughter. These were militant workers, too, unionists with a radical awareness of their situation. Goldman sent off a letter to Evelyn. I am often asked the question, how can the masses permit themselves to be exploited by the few? The answer is, by being persuaded to identify with them. Carrying his newspaper with your picture, the laborer goes home to his wife, an exhausted workhorse with the veins standing out in her legs, and he dreams not of justice, but of being rich. Evelyn did not know what to do with such remarks. She continued to testify as she had contracted to do. She made appearances with the Thaw family and produced by means of glances and small gestures of devotion images of a wife. She portrayed Harry as the victim of an irrepressible urge to find honor for himself and his young bride. She performed flawlessly. She heard the scratch-scratch of the steel drawing pens. Legal bystanders in spectacles and celluloid collars stroked their mustaches. Everyone in the courtroom wore black. She wondered at this huge establishment of legal people who lay waiting in their lives for conventions such as this. Judges and lawyers and bailiffs and policemen and wardens and jurymen. They'd all known there would be a trial for them. She heard the scratches. Waiting in the corridors were alienists prepared to testify that Harry was insane. This was the one line of defense he would not permit. He could not bring himself to do it. His august mother wanted him to make that plea. She was afraid that if he did not, he would go to the electric chair. Evelyn watched him at the defense table. She wondered what in the world could ever put to ease that enraged heart. Harry kept his facial expressions key to the testimony. When something was funny, he smiled. When it was sad, he dropped his eyes. When Stanford White's name was mentioned, he furrowed his brow. He arranged himself in attitudes of contrition, alternated with heads-up confidence and even burning righteousness. This activity required all his concentration. Going in and out of the courtroom, he was calm and courteous, the picture of rationality. It occurred to Evelyn one day that Harry might indeed love her. She was stunned. She tried to make a determination of the real truth of their relationship, of the relationship of the three of them. For the first time, she experienced acutely the sense of Stanford White's death, the loss of Stanny. He would have been able to tell her what the truth was. He would have made a joke out of it. That was his way. He was a lusty old fuck, and he loved a good laugh. She could drive him out of his mind as she could drive Harry out of his. But she felt more comfortable with Stanley White. He would leave her alone to go out and build something, whereas Harry would never leave her, because he had nothing else to do. Harry was merely wealthy. She needed desperately to talk to someone, and the only person she'd ever been able to talk to was the man for whose death she was directly responsible. On her blue vellum, Mrs. Harry K. Thaw stationery, with raised letters, she wrote Emma Goldman. "What have I done?" she said in the letter. The reply came back from California, where Goldman was raising funds in defense of the militant McNamara brothers, who were accused of blowing up the Los Angeles Times building. "Don't overestimate your role in the relationship those two men had with each other," Goldman said. In the meantime, Harry's trial went to the jury. They could not come to a verdict. A new trial was ordered. Evelyn testified again, with the same words and the same gestures. When it was all over, Harry K. Thaw was remanded for an indefinite period to the Matawan Hospital for the Criminally Insane. Almost immediately, his lawyers negotiated for his divorce. Evelyn was ready. Her price was $1 million. Then the private detectives came forward with their record of her infidelities with Mother's younger brother and some others they had made up, and the divorce was quietly concluded by the payment to Evelyn of $25,000. Evelyn sat on the bed in her hotel suite, which she now had to give up, and gazed at her evening slippers, which she held in her hand. On this particular occasion, younger brother's endearments left her cold. She remembered what Goldman had told her on her last visit to New York. "However much money you have gotten from Thaw, it is only as much as he wanted to give you. It is the law of wealth that such people only profit from the money that is taken from them. It's the way things work. Somehow every dollar paid over to you has resulted in his profit, and you will be left with a finite amount of money that you will spend and waste until you are as poor as when you started." She knew this was true. Even such money as she had, still the bulk of her fortune, left her with strange and inconclusive feelings. Some man would feign love, steal the money, and break her heart. For this bitter insight she had only Goldman to thank, who had painted for her two pictures, one of greed and barbarity, starvation, injustice, and death, as in the present national organization of private capital, and the other of utopian serenity, as in the loose, ungoverned combinations of equals sharing their work and their wealth sensibly with one another. Evelyn made donations to Goldman's anarchist magazine, Mother Earth, to keep it going. She supported radical appeals that came to her from all over the country once it became underground gossip that she had been politicized. She gave money to the legal defense of labor leaders who had been thrown in jail. She gave money to the parents of children mutilated in mills and factories. Listlessly, she doled out her hard-earned fortune. The public never knew this because she insisted on anonymity. She had no joy. She looked into the mirror and saw the unmistakable lineaments of womanhood coming into her girlish face. Her long, beautiful neck seemed to her like an ungainly stalk, upon which was perched a sad-eyed, ridiculous head of a whore past her prime. She cried for the snuggling opportunities of a body like Stanford White's. And all the while, Mother's younger brother solemnly and in his doggish, silent way stood to wait upon her. He didn't know the meaning of comfort. He couldn't tease her or talk baby talk to her. He couldn't tell her how to look at a diamond or take her to a restaurant where the maitre d' fawned over him. All he could do was commit his life to hers and work to satisfy her smallest whim. She loved him, but she wanted someone who would treat her badly, and whom she could treat badly. She longed for a challenge to her wit. She longed to have her ambitions aroused once again. Chapter 12. And what of Tata and his little girl? After that meeting, the old artist sat one night and one day in his flat, and he did not eat or say anything, brooding as he smoked endlessly his Sobrani cigarettes on the brutal luck of his life. Every once in a while he would look at his child, and seeing the sure destruction of her incredible beauty in his continuing victimization, he would clutch her to him and tears would fill his eyes. The little girl quietly prepared their simple meals in ways so reminiscent of the movements of his wife that finally he could bear the situation no longer. Throwing their few clothes in a musty suitcase whose strap had long since rotted away, he tied a piece of clothesline around the suitcase, took the girl by the hand, and left the two-room flat on Hester Street forever. They walked to the corner and boarded the number 12 streetcar for Union Square. At Union Square they transferred to the number 8 and rode north up Broadway. The early evening was warm, and all the windows of the trolley were lowered. The streets were crowded with cabs and cars, and their horns blew at one another. Trolleys went along in clusters, their bells ringing, the flashes of electricity from their pantographs crackling along the overhead wires in minute intensifications of the heat lightning that flattened the sky over the darkening, sultry city. Tata had no idea where he was going. The little girl held his hand tightly. Her dark eyes stared solemnly at the parades of people strolling along Broadway, the men in boaters and blue blazers and white ducks, the women in white summer frocks. The electric light bulbs of each vaudeville house rippled in a particular pattern. A ring of light spun around the rims of her pupils. 3 hours later, they were on a streetcar moving north along Webster Avenue in the Bronx. The moon was out, the temperature had dropped, and the trolley clipped along the broad reaches of this wide boulevard with only occasional stops. They passed grassy lots interspersed with blocks of row houses still under construction. Finally, the lights disappeared entirely, and the little girl realized they were traveling along the edges of a great hillside cemetery. The stones and vaults standing against the cold night sky suggested to her the fate of her mother. For the first time, she asked her Tata where they were going. He pulled the window shut against the cold wind whistling now through the ratcheting, rocking trolley. They were the only passengers. "Shah," he said to her, "close your eyes." Distributed in his pockets and in his shoes were his life savings, some $30. He had decided to leave New York, the city that had ruined his life. There was, in these days of our history, a highly developed system of interurban street railway lines. One could travel great distances on hard rush seats or wooden benches by taking each line to its terminus and transferring to the next. Tata did not know anything about the routes. He only planned to keep going as far as each streetcar would take him. In the early hours of the first morning of the trip, they crossed the city line into Mount Vernon, New York, and there learned that the next service would not begin till daylight. They found a small park and slept in the bandshell. In the morning they washed and refreshed themselves in a public facility. As the sun came up, they boarded a bright red and yellow streetcar, and the conductor greeted them cheerfully. Tata paid a nickel for himself, 2 cents for the child. On the wooden floor of the car at the rear were stacked crates filled with wet and glistening quart bottles of milk. Tata offered to buy one. The conductor looked at him and then at the little girl and told him to take one out, but didn't wait to be paid for it. He pulled a cord, the trolley bell rang, and the car lurched into motion. The conductor sang. He was a robust, big-bellied man with a tenor voice. He had a change-making machine strapped to his belt. A while later, the streetcar entered the city of New Rochelle, New York, and slowly made its way up Main Street. Traffic was heavier now, the sun was up, and the small city was a bustle. It was explained to Tata that if he wanted to ride through, he had to transfer to the Post Road shoreline at the corner of North Avenue. This was done by paying another penny for each transfer. Tata and the little girl got off at the corner of Main Street and North Avenue and waited for the connecting trolley. A boy and his mother passed by. The little girl looked at the boy. He was tow-headed. He wore a sailor blouse, dark blue knickers, white socks, and polished white shoes. His hand was in his mother's hand. And as he passed the little girl standing with her ancient father, the boy's eyes looked into hers. At this moment, the Post Road streetcar appeared, and Tata, holding the little girl firmly by the wrist, walked into the street and stepped aboard. As the car moved off, the little girl watched the boy pass backward in her sight. She stood on the rear platform of the trolley car and watched him until she could no longer see him. His eyes had been blue and yellow and dark green, like a school globe. The streetcar went up the Post Road along the Long Island Sound shoreline to the Connecticut border. In Greenwich, Connecticut, they transferred to another car. This took them up through the cities of Stamford, Norwalk, and then to Bridgeport, the burial place of Tom Thumb. By now they knew how to tell when the end of the line was approaching. The conductor would walk back through the car and reverse the empty seats, going along the aisle and yanking the handles attached to the seat backs without breaking stride. At Bridgeport they transferred again. The tracks turned inland. They stopped for the night in New Haven, Connecticut. They slept in a rooming house and had breakfast in the landlady's dining room. Tata furiously brushed his trousers and jacket and soft cap before going downstairs. He tied a bow tie around his frayed collar. He made sure the little girl wore her clean pinafore. It was a rooming house for university students, and some of them were at the table. They wore gold-rimmed spectacles and turtleneck sweaters. After breakfast, the old artist and his daughter walked to the streetcar tracks and resumed their journey. A car of the Springfield Traction Company took them to New Britain, and then to the city of Hartford. The car slowly swung through the narrow streets of Hartford, the clapboard houses of the city seemingly close enough to reach out and touch. Then they were on the outskirts and racing along north to Springfield, Massachusetts. The great wooden car swayed from side to side. The wind flew in their faces. They sped along the edges of open fields from which birds started and settled as they passed. The little girl saw herds of grazing cows. She saw brown horses loping in the sun. A thin layer of chalk dust settled on her face like a mask, whitening her complexion, bringing out her large, moist eyes, the redness of her mouth. And Tata was momentarily shocked by a vision of her maturity. The car barreled along its tracks down the side of the road, and whenever it approached an intersection, its air horn blew. Once it stopped and took on a load of produce. Riders crowded the aisle. The little girl could not wait for the speed to be up. Tata realized she was happy. She loved the trip. Holding the suitcase on his lap with just one arm, Tata put the other around his child. He found himself smiling. The wind blew in his face and filled his mouth. The car threatened to jump off the tracks. It banged from side to side, and everyone laughed. Tata laughed. He saw the village of his youth going by now, some versts beyond the meadow. There was a church steeple seen above a hill. As a child, he loved wagons. He loved the rides on the big tumbrils in summer moonlight, the bodies of children falling over one another in the hard, bumping wagons. He looked around at the riders on the trolley, and for the first time since coming to America, he thought it might be possible to live here. In Springfield, they bought bread and cheese and boarded a modern dark green car of the Worcester Electric Street Railway. Tata realized now that he was going at least as far as Boston. He computed the cost of all the fares. It would come to $2.40 for him, just over a dollar for the child. The trolley hummed along the dirt roads, the sun behind it now going down in the Berkshires. Stands of fir trees threw long shadows. They passed a single oarsman in a scull on a very quiet, broad stream. They saw a great, dripping mill wheel slowly turning over a creek. The shadows deepened. The little girl fell asleep. Tata clutched the suitcase on his lap and kept his eyes on the tracks ahead, shining now in the single beam of the powerful electric headlamp on the front of the car. Chapter 13. Tracks, tracks! It seemed to the visionaries who wrote for the popular magazines that the future lay at the end of parallel rails. There were long-distance locomotive railroads and interurban electric railroads and street railways and elevated railroads all laying their steel stripes on the land, crisscrossing like the texture of an indefatigable civilization. And in Boston and New York, there were even railroads under the streets, new rapid transit subway systems transporting thousands of people every day. In New York, in fact, the success of the Manhattan subway had created a demand for a line to Brooklyn. Accordingly, an engineering miracle was taking place, the construction of a tunnel under the East River from Brooklyn to the Battery. Sandhogs, working behind a hydraulic shield, excavated riverbed silt inch by inch and installed linking sections of cast-iron tubes as they went. The digging chamber was filled with compressed air pumped in from the surface. The work was dangerous. The men who did the work, the sandhogs, were considered heroes. Working under the river, they were subject to horrible destinies. One typical hazard was the blowout, a situation in which the compressed air found a weakness in the roof of the tunnel and escaped with a violent rush. One day there was a blowout so explosive that it sucked four workmen out of the tunnel and blew them through 20 feet of river silt and shot them up through the river itself 40 feet into the air on the crest of a geyser. Only one of the men survived. The freak accident made headlines in all the papers, and when Harry Houdini read the accounts over his morning coffee, he hurriedly dressed and rushed downtown to Bellevue Hospital, where it was said the surviving worker had been taken. "I'm Harry Houdini," he told the admissions desk, "and I've got to see that sandhog." Two nurses conferred behind the desk, and while they did, he stole a glance at the charts and ran upstairs. "You can't come up here," a flinty nurse told him as he strode down a ward filled with sick and dying men. Shoots of cheerful morning sun leaned like buttresses from the high, dirty windows of the ward. Clustered about the bed of the heroic sand hog was his family, a wife, an old mother and a babushka, two strapping sons. The doctor was in attendance. The man in the bed was swathed in bandages from his head to his feet. His arms and casts were supported in traction, as was one encased leg. Every few moments there would issue from his head bandages a weak, or perhaps only a decorous groan. Houdini cleared his throat. "I'm Harry Houdini," he said to the family. "I escape for a living. That's my profession. I'm an escapologist. But let me tell you, I've never done an escape that can touch this one." He pointed to the bed. The family looked at him without expression on their stolid Slavic faces. The grandmother, without taking her eyes off Houdini, said something in a foreign language. A question it was, because one of the sons answered in kind and said Houdini's name. They continued to look at him. "I came to offer my respects," Houdini said. They all had flat faces, broad brows, eyes set widely apart. They did not return his smile. "How did you get in here?" the doctor said. "I'll only be a minute," Houdini said. "I just want to ask him something." "I think you better leave," the doctor said. Houdini turned to the family. "I want to know how it felt. I want to know what he did to get to the surface. He was the only one to make it. He must have done something. I would like to know. It means a lot to me to know." He took out his wallet, removed some bills. "I think you could probably use this. Go ahead, take it. I would like to help." The family continued to gaze at him. A sound came from the figure on the bed. One of the sons leaned over and put his ear down. He listened a moment and nodded. He went to the other son and said something to him. They were big fellows, over 6 feet, with chests like barrels. "No rough stuff," the doctor said. Houdini found himself lifted by the arms and walked down the aisle of the ward with his feet just failing to touch the floor. He made a decision not to resist. He knew the tricks of self-defense. There were ways he could best these oafs, but this was a hospital after all. Houdini walked through the streets. His ears burned with humiliation. He wore a hat with the brim turned down. He wore a tight-fitting double-breasted linen jacket, and he kept his hands in the pockets of the jacket. He wore tan trousers and brown and white shoes with pointed toes. It was a chilly autumn afternoon, and most people wore coats. He moved swiftly through the crowded New York streets. He was incredibly live. There was a kind of act that used the real world for its stage. He couldn't touch it. For all his achievements, he was a trickster, an illusionist, a mere magician. What was the sense of his life if people walked out of the theater and forgot him? The headlines on the newsstand said Perry had reached the pole. The real world act was what got into the history books. Houdini decided to concentrate on his outdoor exploits. Going on tour, he escaped from a packing case nailed shut and tied with ropes that had been lowered into the freezing Detroit River. He had himself lowered into rivers in Boston and Philadelphia. Ice floated in the rivers. He practiced for the freezing river escapes by sitting in his bathtub at home with blocks of ice dropped in there by the iceman. But nothing was changed. He decided to do a European tour. He had gotten his start in Europe when he had been unable to crack the big-time vaudeville circuits in the States. In some peculiar way, he still felt the people in Europe understood him better than his own countrymen. A few days before his departure, he agreed to do a benefit for old magicians and retired theater folk. He wanted to surprise them with a new escape. He hired a team of orderlies from Bellevue to come up on the stage and wrap him from head to foot in bandages. This was done. Then they wound him in numbers of sheets, and then they strapped him to a hospital bed. Then they poured water over him to weigh down the wrappings. Houdini escaped. The old theater people went wild. He was unsatisfied. Houdini was to sail for Europe on the Imperator, an immense German vessel with a figurehead, an odd thing for a modern three-stack passenger liner. The figurehead was a crowned eagle with its claws embedded in the world. Houdini's ancient mother, Mrs. Weiss, came down to the pier to see him off. She was a neat little woman in black. He kissed her and hugged her and kissed her hands and went up the gangplank. He ran back down the gangplank and kissed her again, holding her face in his hands and kissing her eyes. She nodded and patted him. He ran up the gangplank and waved. He wasn't sure she could see him. As the great liner backed into the river, he stood at the rail and waved. He waved his cap to attract her attention. It was obvious she could not see him. He shouted, ridiculously, because the ship's engines were churning up the river water. He continued to watch her small black figure and ran around to the port deck when tugs faced the ship downriver. She stood on the pier, a frail, sweet old lady, and watched the ship drift out of her vision. She enjoyed her son's devotions. Once he had come to her and had her hold out her apron. Into the apron he poured 50 shiny gold dollars. He was a good boy. She returned by cab to their home on 113th Street to wait for him. Houdini opened his European tour at the Hansa Theater in Hamburg. The audiences were enthusiastic. The papers gave him lots of space. He'd never known such feelings of dissatisfaction. He wondered why he'd devoted his life to mindless entertainment. The audiences cheered. After every show, there was always a small crowd at the stage entrance. He was short with them. Then, one day, he attended the public demonstration of a French-made flying machine, a Voisin, a beautiful biplane with boxed wings, a box rudder, and three delicately strutted bicycle wheels. The aviator flew it over a racetrack and landed on the infield, and the next day his feat was described in the newspapers. Houdini moved decisively. Within a week he was the owner of a new Voisin biplane. It had cost him $5,000. It came complete with a French mechanic who gave instruction in the art of flying. He secured the use of an army parade grounds outside of Hamburg. In all the countries in which he played, he always got on well with the military. Soldiers everywhere were fans of his. Each morning at dawn, he would drive to the parade grounds and sit at the controls of the Voisin while the French mechanic lectured him on the function and purpose of the levers and pedals within reach of the pilot. The plane was directed by means of a large steering wheel mounted in the vertical position and attached by a shaft to the front rudder. The pilot sat behind the front rudder on a little seat between the two wings. Behind him was the engine, and behind the engine was the propeller. The Voisin was made of wood. The wings were covered in fabric, stretched taut and sized with varnish. The struts connecting the double wings were paneled with the same material. The Voisin looked like a box kite. Houdini had his name painted in block letters on the outside panels of the wings and on the rear elevators. He could hardly wait for his first flight. The patient mechanic drilled him in the various operations required to get the machine aloft, maintain it in flight, and land it. Every night Houdini did his act, and every morning at dawn he went out for his lessons. Finally, one morning when the red sky was clear and the mechanic judged the wind conditions to be right, they pushed the machine out of its shed and faced it into the breeze. Houdini climbed into the pilot's seat, turned his cap backwards, and pulled it down tight. He clutched the wheel. His eyes narrowed in concentration. He set his jaw firmly, and he turned his head and nodded to the mechanic who spun the wood propeller. The engine fired. It was an Enfield 80-horsepower job, supposedly better than the one the Wrights themselves were using. Hardly daring to breathe, Houdini throttled the engine, idled it, throttled it again. Finally, he held up his thumb. The mechanic ducked under the wings and pulled the wheel chocks. The craft slowly moved forward. Houdini breathed faster and faster as the Voisin picked up speed. Soon it was bumping along the ground, and he could feel the sensitive wings take on an intelligence of their own, as if a disembodied presence had joined the enterprise. The machine lifted off the ground. He thought he was dreaming. He had to willfully restrain his emotions, commanding himself sternly to keep the wings level, to keep the throttle continuously in touch with the speed of the flight. He was flying. His feet worked the pedals. He clasped the control wheel, and gently the rudder in front of him tilted down, and the machine climbed the sky. He dared to look down. The earth was 50 feet below him. He no longer heard the ratcheting engine behind his ear. He felt the wind in his face and discovered he was shouting. The guy wires seemed to sing. The great wings above and below him nodded and dipped and played in the air with their incredibly gentle intelligence. The bicycle wheels spun slowly, idly in the breeze. He was flying over a stand of trees. Gaining confidence, he put the craft into a difficult maneuver, a bank. The Voisin described a wide circle around the parade grounds. Then he could see the mechanic standing in the distance by the shed, raising both arms in salute. Coolly, Houdini leveled the wings, slipped under his breeze, and began his descent. The moment the wheels touched down, the crudeness of the impact offended him, and when the machine rolled to a stop, he wanted only to be airborne again. On subsequent flights, Houdini stayed in the air as much as 10 or 12 minutes. That was virtually to challenge the fuel capacity of the plane. He seemed at times to drift as if suspended from the clouds over his head. He was able to see whole villages nestled below in the German countryside, and to follow his own shadow down incredibly straight roads lined with hedgerows. Once he flew high enough to be able to see in the distance the medieval skyline of Hamburg with flashes of the Elbe River. He was tremendously proud of his airplane. He wanted to make flying history. Young officers from the local Kasern began to come to the parade grounds to watch Houdini fly. He got to know some of them by name. And then the commandant, whose permission had been required for the use of the parade grounds, asked Houdini if he would be interested in giving a few lectures to these young officers on the art of flying. The magician readily agreed. He arranged his schedule accordingly and began a series of informal sessions. He liked the young officers. They were highly intelligent and very respectful. They laughed at his jokes. His German was faulty and Yiddish inflected, but they seemed not to notice. One morning after flight, Houdini taxed his plane to the shed and noticed waiting there a Mercedes staff car carrying general officers of the Imperial German Army. Before he could disembark, his friend the commandant stood up from the jump seat of the car, saluted him, and asked him in a most formal manner if he would mind taking the Voisin up again for a demonstration flight. Houdini looked at the two elderly men, heavily medaled, sitting in the rear of the car. They nodded at him. Sitting at attention in the front seat next to the driver was an enlisted man who wore the spiked helmet and held a carbine across his lap. At this moment, a white Daimler Landau, with an enclosed carriage for the passengers, slowly pulled up behind the staff car. Its brass fittings were polished to a brilliance, and even its white wooden wheel spokes were clean. A gold-fringed flag of rank flew from the right front fender. Houdini could not see into the passenger cab. "Of course," he said. He ordered his mechanic to refuel, and in a few minutes was aloft once more, making wide, stately banks around the field. Tried to imagine how he must look from the ground. He felt the thrill of performance. He whirred over the cars at a height of 100 feet and came around again at 50 feet, waggling his wings and waving. He flew for whoever it was in that white car. When he landed, he was escorted to the big Daimler. The chauffeur opened the door and stood at attention. Sitting in the car was the Archduke Franz Ferdinand, heir to the Austro-Hungarian throne. The Archduke was dressed in the uniform of a field marshal of the Austrian army. He held in the crook of his arm a plumed helmet. His hair was cut very short and flat on top, like a brush. He had large wax mustaches that curled upward, and he gazed at Houdini with stupid, heavy-lidded eyes. Sitting next to him was his wife, the Countess Sophie, a stately matron yawning delicately behind a gloved hand. The Archduke Franz Ferdinand didn't seem to know who Houdini was. He congratulated him on the invention of the aeroplane. Part 2, Chapter 14. When Father returned to New Rochelle, he walked up the front steps of his home, passed under the giant Norwegian maples, and found his wife holding a brown baby in her arms. Upstairs, the colored girl was withdrawn. Melancholy had taken the will out of her muscles. She did not have the strength to hold her baby. She sat all day in her attic room and watched the diamond window panes as they gathered the light, glowed with it, and then gave it up. Father looked at her through the open door. She ignored him. He wandered through the house, finding everywhere signs of his own exclusion. His son now had a desk, as befitted all young students. He thought he heard an arctic wind, but it was the housemaid, Bridget, pushing an electric suction cleaner across the rug in the parlor. What was strangest of all was the mirror in his bath. It gave back the gaunt, bearded face of a derelict, a man who lacked a home. His shaving mirror on the Roosevelt had not revealed this. He removed his clothes. He was shocked by the outlines of his body, the ribs and clavicle, white-skinned and vulnerable, the bony pelvis, the organ hanging there redder than anything else. At night, in bed, Mother held him and tried to warm the small of his back, curled him into her as she lay against his back, cradling his strange coldness. It was apparent to them both that this time he'd stayed away too long. Downstairs, Bridget put a record on the Victrola, wound the crank, and sat in the parlor smoking a cigarette and listening to John McCormack sing "I Hear You Calling Me." She was doing what she could to lose her place. She was no longer efficient or respectful. Mother marked this change from the arrival of the colored girl. Father related it to the degrees of turn in the moral planet. He saw it everywhere this new season, and it bewildered him. At his office, he was told that the seamstresses in the flag department had joined a New York union. He put on clothes from his closet that ballooned from him as shapeless as the furs he had worn for a year. He had brought home gifts. He gave his son a pair of walrus tusks and a whale's tooth with Eskimo carvings. He gave his wife the fur of a white polar bear. He pulled Arctic treasures from his trunks, notebooks of his journals, their covers curling at the corners, their pages stiff as pages that have been wet, a signed photograph of Commander Perry, a bone harpoon tip, 3 or 4 tins of unused tea, incredible treasures in the north, but here in the parlor the embarrassing possessions of a savage. The family stood round and watched him on his knees. There was nothing he had to tell them. On the northern arc of the world was a darkness and a coldness that had crept upon him and rounded his shoulders. Waiting for Perry to return to the Roosevelt, he had heard the wind howl at night and had clasped with love and gratitude the foul body like a stinking fish of an Eskimo woman. He had put his body into the stinking fish. The old Anglo-Saxon word he had hardly dared think of. That is what he had done. Now, in New Rochelle, he smelled on himself the oil of fish liver, fish on his breath, fish in his nostrils. He scrubbed himself red. He looked in mother's eyes to detect there his justice. He found, instead, a woman curious and alerted to his new being. He realized that every night since he'd returned, they had slept in the same bed. She was in some way not as vigorously modest as she'd been. She took his gaze. She came to bed with her hair unbraided. Her hand one night brushed down his chest and came to rest below his nightshirt. He decided God had punishments in store so devious there was no sense trying to anticipate what they were. With a groan he turned to her and found her ready. Her hands pulling his face to hers did not feel the tears. But the house, with its bay windows and beveled corners and 3 dormers, loomed out of the yard like a ship. The rolled awnings were lashed to the windows. He stood on the sidewalk in the morning of a brilliant November day. The fallen leaves were covered with frost and lay like lapping waves about the house. The wind blew. He had come back with a slight limp. He thought about preparing his homecoming lecture for the New York Explorers Club. He found he preferred to sit in the parlor, his feet near a small electric heater. Everyone in the family treated him like a convalescent. His son brought him beef tea. The boy had grown taller. He had lost some of his fat. He was becoming competent and useful. He intelligently discussed Halley's Comet. Father felt childlike beside him. In the paper was the news of Teddy Roosevelt's African safari. The great conservationist had bagged 17 lions, 11 elephants, 21 rhinos, 8 hippos, 9 giraffes, 47 gazelles, 29 zebras, and kudu, wildy beast, impala, eland, waterbuck, warthog, and bushbuck beyond number. As for the business during father's absence, it seemed to have got on well. Mother could now speak crisply of such matters as unit cost, inventory, and advertising. She had assumed executive responsibilities. She had made changes in certain billing procedures and contracted with 4 new sales agents in California and Oregon. Everything she had done stood up under his examination. He was astounded. On Mother's bedside table was a volume entitled The Lady's Battle by Molly Elliott Sewell. He found also a pamphlet on the subject of family limitation, and the author was Emma Goldman, the anarchist revolutionary. Down in the shop, under a translucent window, he discovered his brother-in-law hunched over a drawing table. Mother's younger brother was losing his blonde hair. He was pale and thin, and more uncommunicative than ever. Most remarkable was the time he now spent at work, 12 and 15 hours a day. He had taken for his province the fireworks division of the business, and had designed dozens of new rockets, fire wheels, and an unusual firecracker packed not cylindrically, but in a spherical container. With its fuse looking like a stem, it was named a cherry bomb. The 2 men went one morning to younger brother's testing ground at the end of the trolley line in the salt marshes. They wore heavy black coats and bowlers. Father stood on a slight rise at the edge of the tall grass. On a dried mud flat 50 yards away, younger brother bent down and prepared his demonstration. He had arranged with father that the first combustion would be that of the standard firecracker and the second of the cherry bomb design. He suddenly stood up, held one arm aloft, and backed away a few paces. Father heard the faint pop of the firecracker. after he saw a wisp of smoke erased by the wind. Younger brother now moved forward again, bent down and backed away, this time more quickly. He held up two arms. An explosion then occurred like a bomb. Seagulls were suddenly wheeling through the air, and father felt the after-concussion as a ringing in his ears. He was quite alarmed. When younger brother rejoined him, his face was flushed and his eyes glistened. Father suggested that perhaps the charge was too powerful and might do injury. "I don't want to produce something that would put a child's eye out," father said. Younger brother said nothing, but walked back to his proving ground and lit another cherry bomb, this time standing up a bare pace or two from the fuse. He stood as if in a shower bath, his face upturned to the water. He held out his arms. The bomb exploded. Again he bent down and again held out his arms. The bomb exploded. The birds turned in widening circles, soaring out over the sound, swooping over whitecaps and hovering on the wind. The young man was in mourning. Gradually, Evelyn Nesbit had become indifferent to him, and when he persisted in his love, she had become hostile. Finally, one day, she had gone off with a professional ragtime dancer. She left a note. They were going to put together an act. Brother brought home to his room in New Rochelle a wooden crate filled with silhouette portraits and a pair of small beige satin shoes that Evelyn had discarded. Once, standing in nothing but these shoes and white embroidered stockings, she had placed her hands on her thighs and stared at him over her shoulder. He lay on his bed for days after his return. At times he would grab himself as if to pull his sex out by the roots. He would pace his room and hold his hands over his ears and hum loudly when he heard her voice. He could not look at the silhouettes. He wanted to pack his heart with gunpowder and blow it up. Without warning, one dawn he awoke with her scent in his nostrils. This, of all his memories, was the most vicious. He ran downstairs and threw the stack of silhouettes and the satin shoes in the trash can. Then he shaved and went off to the flag and fireworks factory. The silhouette portraits were recovered by his nephew. Chapter 15. The boy treasured anything discarded. He took his education peculiarly and lived an entirely secret intellectual life. He had his eye on his father's Arctic journals, but would not attempt to read them unless father no longer cared about them. In his mind, the meaning of something was perceived through its neglect. He looked over the silhouettes, examining them carefully, and chose one of them to hang on the inside of his wardrobe door. It was a study of the artist's most frequent model, a girl with hair like a helmet and the posture of someone who might run at any moment. She wore the battered high-lace shoes and sagging socks of poor children. He hid the rest of the silhouette collection in the attic. He was alert not only to discarded materials, but to unexpected events and coincidences. He learned nothing at school, but he did well because nothing was demanded of him. His teacher was an iron-haired woman who trained her students in declamation and clapped her hands as they practiced in their notebooks the curved lines that were thought to encourage good penmanship. At home, he showed a fondness for the Motor Boys books and rarely missed an issue of Wild West Weekly, and for some reason these tastes, which the family found unexceptional, were a comfort to them. Mother suspected he was a strange child, although she shared the sense of him with no one, not even father. Any indication that her son was ordinary heartened her. She wished he had friends. Father was still not himself, and younger brother was too tormented by his own concerns to be of use, so it was left to grandfather to cultivate what might be the boy's oddity or merely his independence of spirit. The old man was very thin and stooped, and he emitted a mildewed smell, possibly because he had few clothes and refused to buy or accept anything new. Also, his eyes were constantly watering, but he would sit in the parlor and tell the boy stories from Ovid. They were stories of people who became animals or trees or statues. They were stories of transformation. Women turned into sunflowers, spiders, bats, birds. Men turned into snakes, pigs, stones, and even thin air. The boy did not know he was hearing Ovid, and it would not have mattered if he had known. Grandfather's stories proposed to him that the forms of life were volatile, and that everything in the world could as easily be something else. The old man's narrative would often drift from English to Latin, without his being aware of it, as if he were reading to one of his classes of 40 years before, so that it appeared nothing was immune to the principle of volatility, not even language. The boy thought of his grandfather as a discarded treasure. He accepted the stories as images of truth, and therefore as propositions that could be tested. He found proof in his own experience of the instability of both things and people. He could look at the hairbrush on the bureau, and it would sometimes slide off the edge and fall to the floor. If he raised the window in his room, it might shut itself at the moment he thought the room was getting cold. He liked to go to the moving picture shows downtown at the New Rochelle Theater on Main Street. He knew the principles of photography, but saw also that moving pictures depended on the capacity of humans, animals, or objects to forfeit portions of themselves, residues of shadow and light which they left behind. He listened with fascination to the Victrola and played the same record over and over, whatever it happened to be, as if to test the endurance of a duplicated event. And then he took to studying himself in the mirror, perhaps expecting some change to take place before his eyes. He could not see that he was taller than he had been even a few months before, or that his hair was darkening. Mother noticed his new attention to himself and understood it as the vanity of a boy beginning to think of himself as a man. Certainly he had passed the age of sailor suits. Always discreet, she said nothing, but she was very pleased. In fact, he continued the practice not from vanity, but because he discovered the mirror as a means of self-duplication. He would gaze at himself until there were two selves facing one another, neither of which could claim to be the real one. The sensation was of being disembodied. He was no longer anything exact as a person. He had the dizzying feeling of separating himself endlessly. He would entrance himself so deeply in this process that he would be unable to come out of it even though his mind was lucid. He would have to rely on some outside stimulus, a loud noise or a change in the light coming through the window, to capture his attention and make him whole again. And what of his own father? The burly, self-confident man who'd gone away and came back gaunt and hunched and bearded, or of his uncle shedding his hair in his lassitude. Down at the bottom of the Broadview Avenue hill one day, the city fathers unveiled a bronze statue of some old Dutch governor, a fierce-looking man with a square-topped hat, a cape, pantaloons, and buckle shoes. The family was on hand for that. There were other statues in the city parks, and the boy knew them all. He believed that statues were one way of transforming humans, and in some cases horses. Yet even statues did not remain the same, but turned different colors or lost bits and pieces of themselves. It was evident to him that the world composed and recomposed itself constantly in an endless process of dissatisfaction. The winter turned extremely cold and dry, and the ponds of New Rochelle became ideal for skating. On Saturdays and Sundays, mother and younger brother and the boy would skate on the pond in the woods at the bottom of Payne Avenue, the street adjoining Broadview. Younger brother would skate off by himself, taking long, solemn, and graceful strides across the ice, his hands behind his back, his head bowed. Mother wore a fur hat and a long black coat, and held her hands in a muff, and skated with her son holding her arm. She hoped to divert him from his lonely indoor pursuits. It was a merry scene, with children and adults from all over the neighborhood skating over the white ice, long, colorful scarves streaming from their necks, cheeks and noses red. People fell and laughed and were picked up. Dogs struggled to keep their balance as they followed the children about. There was the constant cut-cut of the skate blades on the ice. Some families had wicker chairs on runners for the elderly or less daring, and these were pushed about with solicitude. But the boy's eyes saw only the tracks made by the skaters, traces quickly erased of moments past, journeys taken. Chapter 16. This same winter found Tata and his daughter in the mill town of Lawrence, Massachusetts. They had come there the previous autumn, having heard there were jobs. Tata stood in front of a loom for 56 hours a week. His pay was just under $6. The family lived in a wooden tenement on a hill. They had no heat. They occupied one room overlooking an alley in which residents customarily dumped their garbage. He feared she would fall victim to the low-class elements of the neighborhood. He refused to enroll her in school. It was easier here than in New York to avoid the authorities, and made her stay home when he was not there to go out with her. After work, he'd walk with her for an hour through the dark streets. She became thoughtful. She held her shoulders straight and walked like a woman. He was torturing himself, anticipating her maturity. At such time, when the girl becomes a woman, she needs a mother to instruct her. Would she have to go through this difficult change alone? Alternatively, if he found someone to marry, how would she take to the new person? It might be the worst thing in the world for her. The dismal wooden tenements lay in endless rows. Every one from Europe was there, the Italians, the Poles, the Belgians, the Russian Jews. The feeling was not good between the different groups. One day, the biggest of the mills, American Woolen Company, gave out envelopes with short pay, and a tremor went through the workers in the plant. Several Italian workers left their machines. They ran through the mill calling for a strike. They pulled out wires and threw lumps of coal through the windows. Others followed them. The anger spread. Throughout the city, people left their machines. Those who couldn't make up their minds were carried along in the momentum. In 3 days, every textile mill in Lawrence was virtually shut down. Tata was overjoyed. "We were going to starve to death or freeze to death," he told his daughter. "Now we'll be shot to death." But people from the IWW who knew how to run a strike quickly came up from New York and organized things. A strike committee was formed with every one of the races represented, and the message went out to the workers, "No violence." Taking the girl with him, Tata joined the thousands of pickets encircling the mill, a massive brick building that went on for blocks. They trudged under the cold gray sky. Trolley cars came down the street, the drivers peering at the sight of thousands of marchers moving silently through the snow. Overhead, the telephone and telegraph wires drooped with ice. Militia with rifles nervously guarded the mill gates. The militia all had overcoats. There were many incidents. A woman worker was shot in the street. The only ones with guns were the police and the militia, but the two strike leaders, Ettore and Giovanetti, were arrested for complicity in the shooting. They were put in jail pending their trial. Something of the sort had been expected. Tata went down to the train station to be on hand for the arrival in Lawrence of replacements for Ettore and Giovanetti. There was an immense crowd. Out of the train stepped Big Bill Haywood, the most famous wobbly of them all. He was a Westerner and wore a Stetson, which he now removed and waved. A cheer went up. Haywood raised his hands for quiet. He spoke. His voice was magnificent. "There is no foreigner here except the capitalists," he said. The place went wild. Afterward, everyone marched through the streets and sang the International. The girl had never seen her Tata so inflamed. She liked the strike because it got her out of the room. She held his hand. But the battle went on week after week. Relief committees had set up kitchens in every neighborhood. "It's not charity," a woman told Tata, when, after the child received her portion, he refused his. "The bosses want you weak. Therefore you have to be strong. The people who help us today will need our help tomorrow." On the picket line each cold day, they wrapped their scarves around their necks and stamped their feet in the cold snow. The little girl's cloak was threadbare. Tata volunteered for service on the strike display committee and got them off the cold streets by designing posters. The posters were very beautiful, but the man in charge told him they were not right. "We don't want art," the man said. "We want something to stir the anger. We want to keep the fire stoked." Tata had drawn pickets, stark figures with their feet in snow. He had drawn families huddled in their tenements. He switched to lettering. "All for one and one for all." He felt better. At night he took home scraps of paper, oak tag, pens, and India ink, and to take the child's mind off their troubles, he began to entertain her with silhouette drawings. He created a streetcar scene, the people getting on and off. She loved it. She leaned it against her bed pillow and looked at it from different angles. This gave him an inspiration.